This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. The history of the Civil War is filled with familiar names, military leaders who planned and executed battles, war heroes, and political leaders from the Union and the Confederacy. But the war altered the lives of thousands of otherwise ordinary Americans. James Tanner was a teenager who fought, briefly, in the Civil War and was seriously injured. But it was his career in civil service after the war that was extremely well known at the time, but is almost entirely forgotten today. History writer James Martin believes it's a story worth knowing. His new book is called America's Corporal, James Tanner in War and Peace. Martin, who is the chair of the history department at Marquette University, spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich last month about how his book came to be.
Another book came out a couple of years ago about Civil War veterans in general. And I guess I encountered Tanner first as a caricature. The humor magazine Puck hated Civil War pensions or the abuse of Civil War pensions. And Tanner was kind of the lightning rod for criticism for a long time. And at one point, they ran a couple of front page, full color cartoons of him. And one of them is of Tanner standing in front of U.S. Treasury with a long cornucopia snaking back into the building. He's got like a Roman toga on, which was interesting because he didn't have two legs. He had lost both legs. And he's just throwing money out to these grasping hands. And that was really the first time I'd heard his name. I saw a few other things too because he was a pretty prominent veteran. And after I finished the bigger book, I'd never done a biography before, and an opportunity came to write this book for a series at the University of Georgia Press, which is meant to be kind of untold stories, shorter books with a good storyline. And so that's how I came across them.
Well, and this seems like it was something of a challenge, at least as you would expect for most people who came of age in the middle of the 19th century. It does not seem that there was a lot of contemporaneous writing about his early life. What do we know about him in the days before the Civil War?
Not very much. I mean, he was very young. He was 16 when the war started. We know that he had a more education than most because he was still in school, according to the census in 1860, when he was would have turned 16 that year.
And this was in upstate New York.
Right, right, west of Albany. And he was a school teacher, at least part-time, and that's about it.
So he joined the Union cause at 16. From your writing, it sounds like what we do know is that his family didn't especially want him to do that.
His father was reluctant for him to go. I don't think the father seemed to be very supportive of the war effort, but his son was underage, and he had to get his father's permission to go, although he did kind of run away and then came back and got the permission later on. He came from a very democratic part of New York, and so one of the points I make is that he enlists in a regiment that really is being assembled in Brooklyn and New York City, not in Schoharie County, and I think it's because the area is very democratic and not particularly interested in the war for a long time.
His war service was pretty short, pretty uneventful, until the incident that shaped much of the rest of his life.
As far as I can tell, he never fired his gun in anger. He was certainly on campaign several times. He had a little adventure in which he went out into the woods and captured a runaway Confederate or something at one point. That was kind of unclear. But yeah, he sort of witnessed the war without really being a part of it until this day on a hillside and he lost both legs.
What was medical care like for wounded veterans in those days?
As bad as you can imagine it. He had a particularly bad time in that he was captured. This is the Battle of Second Manassas, and it results in pretty much a rout of the Union Army. And so he's wounded about the time his part of the line is collapsing. He's not even in the line. He's behind the line when he's hurt. They carry him to a farmhouse that is a makeshift shelter, at least, not really a hospital. There are 100, 120 other guys there who can't be moved. And so he's actually in Confederate hands for about 10 days with very little care. And so, you know, they dress his legs were amputated below the knee. He is basically unattended. He gets extraordinarily bad bed sores and infection in his back that almost kills him. In fact, the legs don't kill him. The back is much worse.
Right. He describes the worst, the darkest time of his life as being when they had to pour basically hydrochloric acid on his back.
Yeah, without any sort of anesthesia. And he gets through, you know, he's in the hospital about 6 weeks after that, after he's exchanged for other Confederates, and goes home and learns how to walk.
He learns how to walk, and he learns a bunch of other stuff, too. How did he go about reintegrating himself into society as the war was winding down?
Well, very quickly. I think by the end of the – this is early fall 1862 is when he's injured. By early 1863, he's learned stenography or a shorthand.
He basically goes off to business school in Syracuse.
Yeah, exactly. I think he did go there. This was also a correspondence course, but he seemed to actually have attended school in Syracuse. Then he goes back to Washington and gets a job in the War Department. Now, he's kind of back and forth. He also works at Albany during the legislative sessions. He's already kind of getting involved in politics. And as a disabled veteran, he's taking jobs that were reserved for them by middle of the war and afterwards as well.
Well, and the most remarkable story from this part of his life is that he was apparently in the room as President Lincoln died, or so it seems.
Yeah, no one really suggests he wasn't. He lived next door, across the street from Ford's Theater. And when the president is shot in April 1865, they carry him across the street to the Peterson House, which is next door to Tanner's apartment. Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, begins taking testimony immediately after the shooting, and they need a stenographer. And somebody in the room knows Tanner lives next door. And again, Tanner's working in the War Department, so there is a network that he's a part of. And he comes over, and from about 10 or 11 that night till about 5 in the morning, he's taking notes in shorthand for the Secretary of War. And as he's finishing up, the small group is gathering around Lincoln's deathbed, and he kind of wanders into the room and watches him die.
And but for the grace of God, would have been able to write down exactly Lincoln's last words. But it turns out
it was the chaplain's last words, actually. But his pencil was broken, so he couldn't do it. He does correct. Stanton has a very famous "Now he belongs to the ages" line that he says. And for a time it was thought he said now he belongs to the angels. But Tanner, no one knew Tanner was there until he became famous. And he really didn't make much of it until he was famous. And so
he's actually airbrushed out of all the images,
exactly, yeah,
if you will.
And a lot of people are brushed into the images as well. but some of the sketches seem to be accurate in terms of who's there, and he's not. But he corrects this longstanding mistake. His notes are kind of a famous document the Union League Club in Philadelphia has now. And as people were dying off, they commemorate Lincoln's assassination. So this is the second and last person who was in the room when Lincoln died. When he was the last one, it was actually Robert Lincoln, Lincoln's son, and Tanner were the last two. They were about the same age, I suppose.
Right, in their early 20s.
Yeah, yeah.
So Tanner takes up law. He settles in Brooklyn for a time. How does he end up connected to national politics besides, you know, having been sort of around them in Washington during the war?
Well, he joins the Grand Army of the Republic, which is the sort of the American Legion for Civil War soldiers. He is clearly quite political from the very beginning because he's never not involved. I mentioned earlier that he's working for the legislature on and off, you know, as he's reading for the law back in Schoharie. He is quite a speaker. He's a gregarious guy. He likes to be in politics. And then he starts having – he has a job in the Customs House. Then he's the tax collector for Brooklyn, which are very – they're appointed positions, but they're very political. And that's his entree, I think, into it. So as a veteran, as a Republican, he's sort of at the right time and place.
Well, and he winds up getting a pretty plum job in the Harrison administration, Pension Commissioner of the United States.
Which is one of the biggest jobs in the government at the time.
Well, and so what was that? This is not a job that exists today in exactly this way. What was that job responsible for?
All of the pensions being given out to veterans and their widows and orphans and other family members. By this is 1889 is when he's appointed to this position. By this time, pensions are the single largest item in the federal budget, and they'll stay that way for quite a while. He has thousands of employees that he's responsible for, a massive operating budget. They give out $40 million a year or so in pensions.
Which is a lot of money in those days.
A lot of money. It's a lot of money now, I think, but it was a lot of money for the federal government then. There's a brand new building he's sort of in charge of, which is now the National Building Museum.
It's a beautiful building.
It's gorgeous, red brick building. And it's a massive job. It's not quite cabinet level. He doesn't have anything to do with policymaking otherwise, but it's a bigger job than most cabinet level positions.
And he was not what you would call an unqualified success in that job, was he?
He was not. He's fired for 6 months. He resigns, but he's fired. He gets into tiffs with the Secretary of the Interior, is his boss at the time. And over appointments. He kind of cleans out a lot of the former Democratic administrators. He has a very generous pension policy, including re-rating, they call them. So people already getting pensions could apply to have a higher pension if their condition worsened. He actually got his re-rated several times because of his legs. And no one ever really suggested he personally was corrupt, but there seemed to be corruption or at least abuse within the system. And this is a chronic thing that opponents complain about for many years, but he became a scapegoat for it.
Well, and how would you compare the debate over pensions for war veterans to the current state of affairs regarding the VA?
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, I'll mention a difference right now. Opponents of pensions would focus on the fact that many of the men getting pensions probably didn't deserve them. Either they had not really served hard, had hard service. They were coffee coolers and, as they were called, behind the lines guys who had gotten sick since the war. And in fact, the pension law was changed several times. Early on, you had to prove that your disability was a direct result of your war service. By 1889 or so, it was you just had to be a disabled soldier. And eventually, old age could become a disability. And so 500,000 men are on the pension by the 1890s. That seemed excessive to opponents. The Democratic Party tended to be the party that opposed them. And they really took it out on the soldiers. And so the things they would say about the veterans and the things they would say with the GAR associating with veterans that were somehow abusing their rights and this privilege were pretty incredible. And you'll never hear that today talking about veterans.
Well, James Martin, thank you so much for sharing this story, and hopefully it'll spur some interest in other stories like his.
Well, thank you very much.
James Martin's new book is called America's Corporal, James Tanner in War and Peace. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. Martin, who's chair of the history department at Marquette University, first spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke last month. Stay tuned. Up next, we'll discover some places in Milwaukee that aren't immediately apparent. Bobby Tanzillo takes us on a tour of hidden Milwaukee when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.